Strikes on Gaza, city's Al-Zaytun neighborhood also left a number of casualties. The deaths and injuries are also reported following airstrikes in parts of the Al-Shujaya neighborhood as well. The attacks come as health officials have warned there's no safe place in Gaza amid unrelenting Israeli bombing. Over 50,600 Palestinians have now been killed in Gaza since the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war was launched back in October of 2023, along with more than 115,000 Palestinians wounded. And earlier we checked in with our Gaza correspondent, Ghada Ibrahim, for more on latest Israeli attacks across the besieged sliver.
Here in Gaza, the situation remains very tense after nearly 20 days of the Israeli aggressive escalation of the violence. The artillery shells continue to fall on different areas or different parts of eastern and southern of the city of Gaza, on Al-Zaytun neighborhood and on Al-Shaja'iyya, particularly on Al-Nazaz Street and Al-Mansoura streets. At least two Palestinian women were killed in the artillery shells falling on these areas. And the situation in particular in Al-Shaja'iyya is very difficult, as the Israeli occupation army expanded the ground offensive. So the situation from Al-Shaja'iyya is very difficult. The ground operation of the Israeli army continues to expand. The army advances. The Israeli tanks also advance in the eastern parts of Al-Shaja'iyya. Also, this morning, the Israeli war plans committed a massacre in Khan Yunis city that killed three Palestinian workers who were working in a community kitchen, in Khan Yunis. They were targeted by an Israeli airstrike and they were killed while working in a community kitchen.
Now, Hamas has called for the prosecution of Israeli leaders for crimes committed in Gaza amid regime's genocidal campaign against Palestinians, especially the children. Hamas made the call in a statement on the occasion of Palestinian Children's Day, adding the regime's crimes against Palestinian children are not just subject to statute of limitations. The group slammed international silence amid Israeli war crimes in Gaza, saying Israel's impunity encourages the regime to escalate its crimes against Palestinian children. It also called on human rights organizations to assume the responsibility in exposing Israeli crimes and to work diligently to protect the children of Palestine. Hamas said that 19,000 Palestinian children have now been martyred in Gaza since the regime began its aggression against the besieged strip back in late 2023. The movement also said some 39,000 Palestinian kids have lost one or both parents since U.S.-Israeli genocide began. Meanwhile, pro-Palestine rallies have been held in several countries throughout the world on Friday in condemnation of Israel's genocide in Gaza.
The U.S. Embassy and the Americans are partners of a Zionist entity. Here they are. Here is Trump with everything he says to the entire world. He is a danger to the world, a danger to the nation, a danger to the laws of justice, a danger to humanity. The entire West has been exposed, and the free world must stand up to expose these practices and stand with the oppressed. The message of the Jordanian youth and the message of the popular forces is clearly and specifically titled, America is the serious, real, and main partner with the Zionist gangs in the war of extermination, starvation, and displacement.
Jordanians took to the streets of the capital Amman, waving Palestinian flags and chanting anti-Israel slogans. They condemn what they're calling U.S. unconditional support for Israel amid the regime's massacring of the people of Gaza. People in Algeria also marched through the streets holding up banners and flags, voicing support for Gazans. They're calling for an immediate end to Israeli crimes against Palestinians. Similar protests were held in Morocco, Libya, Lebanon, and Japan. The U.S. has launched a new wave of airstrikes on Yemen, continuing its brutal aggression against the Arab country. U.S. fighter jets conducted at least two airstrikes on a Kahlan area east of the city of Sa'ada. No casualties have yet been reported. Areas across Yemen, including Sa'ada, have been repeatedly targeted in recent days. Yemen says attacks are in support of Israel. The Yemeni army has been carrying out anti-Israel military operations in support of the Palestinians in Gaza. Its latest operations targeted military sites and occupied territories.
The UAV force of the Yemeni armed forces carried out a military operation targeting an Israeli military site in the occupied area of Yafa using a Yafa drone. Also, our air defenses, by the grace of Allah, were able to shoot down the reconnaissance drone known as Giant Shark F-360, operated by the American Israeli enemy while carrying out hostile missions in the airspace of Saada Governorate. The drone was shot down using a locally made surface-to-air missile.
Now, Yahya al-Sadi reaffirmed his country's commitment to supporting the oppressed people of Palestine, vowing Yemen will continue its military operations until the Israeli aggression ends and the siege on Gaza is lifted. The Yemeni army spokesman warned silence and inaction in the face of these Israeli atrocities will result in severe consequences. Sadi urged Muslim nations to take swift action to support the Palestinian people and help bring an end to the genocidal onslaught waged against them in Gaza. Activist and political commentator Hussein Abu-Khaiti says the U.S. lacks credible information about the Yemeni military infrastructure and has only been targeting civilians.
President Donald Trump, he have shared yesterday a video on the so-called True Media in his account in a website called True Media, which he said that he showed footage of a gathering of Yemenis and the United States has conducted attack on that gathering. And it's clearly, he said, Trump, he said Houthis gathered for instruction on an attack. And it's clearly from this footage, there were no military, it's not a military site, there was no military equipment. They were civilians, and it's a tribal gathering in Yemen. It's known as common traditional things in Yemen. It's sometimes for Eid or sometimes for a wedding or if there's a kind of trouble between those tribes. They gathered in a kind of a circle. Showing this footage, it shows clearly that the United States hasn't got a clue about where are the Yemeni site and where are the Yemeni launching their missiles attack. And it shows clearly, just like the Zionist State of Israel, when they shoot and they kill civilians and they show those footage, saying that those are actually Hamas fighters, but at the end, it's clearly that they were civilians. And since the attack on Yemen, that Yemeni has expanded and maximums their attack. Instead of, they used to attack United States Navy once every 2 days, now there are a daily attack on the U.S. battleship. There are a daily attack, twice or three, on the Zionist State of Israel.
And Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro says his government is prepared to tackle tariffs imposed by the United States.
Today we are in the best conditions to fulfill the homeland plan for us to continue the process of economic recovery, the construction of our own economic model, and the overcoming of any disturbance that arises from the global tariff trade war that the President of the United States has declared against the world and against Venezuela.
Maduro expressed confidence in Venezuela's ability to overcome the 15% tariffs, which are higher than those in other Latin American countries. Meanwhile, Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney emphasized Canada's resilience in the trade war. He said Canadians didn't ask for this fight, but are always ready when someone else drops the gloves. Earlier on Thursday, he announced the retaliatory measures against U.S. tariffs on the auto import industry. U.S. President Donald Trump's tariffs have sparked global trade tensions, with many countries implementing retaliatory tariffs. And sticking with the subject of Trump's tariffs, the financial penalties have sent ripples through the global financial sector and sparked the sharpest decline in years across major stock markets. FTSE 100 index plunged around 5%, which is the worst daily drop since March of 2015. Also, banks are bearing the brunt of the sell-off across Europe. Paris CAC 40 fell around 4.5%, and Germany's DAX index dropped nearly 5%. The pan-European stock 600 also slid over 5%. Meanwhile, U.S. Markets faced the worst week since the COVID crash, with all three major indices losing over 5%. Asian markets follow the trend, intensifying concerns about a global recession. And in the U.S., a highly charged issue of immigration has become even more contentious following Donald Trump's invocation of the Alien Act of 1798. Now, immigrants and their advocates are increasingly taking to the streets decrying what they view as violations of their human and legal rights, as well as unfair scapegoating of immigrants for economic inequalities. Robbie Mazahari explains from the U.S.
And it's an honor to say. Is the United States currently at war with illegal immigrants? That's the essence of President Donald Trump's argument for invoking wartime authority via the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798. Immediate litigation has made the issue perhaps the most significant matter now pending on the docket of the Supreme Court.
Well, with this president, America, it's at war with everybody, you know, like internally and externally. So, obviously, we're not the enemy. We pay taxes. We work hard every single day. We came because we have to, came to this country. And, you know, this country has a lot of responsibility in our migration. So we need to study and understand history and to check that the root causes of migration. And this country has a lot of responsibility with our communities.
But even in anti-Trump media, Washington's long bipartisan role in destabilizing countries and propping up anti-leftist dictatorships, especially in Latin America, is rarely discussed. Polls show that a majority of Americans approve of Trump's deportations and his handling of immigration, with many blaming them for increased housing prices and stagnant wages. Many say they are being scapegoated for long-running economic inequalities, but immigration arrivals have plunged since Trump took office.
What Trump is doing here, I believe, doesn't represent what most Americans feel about immigrants. So, you know, when I came here, it was easy. You know, I actually became a naturalized citizen. They were even almost begging me to become a citizen, you know.
After a slower start than expected, the Trump administration claims it has deported 100,000 illegal immigrants since taking power on January 20th. But others say the real figure may be half that. What's certain is that Trump has overturned the lives of many immigrants, their families, and their communities.
There are communities that are scared. There are communities that are feeling completely, I would say, disconnected from their realities and norms. And both our pastors who are holding space for congregations that are mixed status, those who have documentation and don't, are scared about and can't go to school, can't go to work, don't know about hospital visits. And so there is significant fear, and we're all impacted by it.
Analysts say that just as so many trace their American experience back to Ellis Island in New York City, in the future, many will trace their family's heritage back to the Joe Biden era of immigration. Ramin Mazahari, Washington, D.C.
Ukraine says Russian missile strike in the center of the country has left at least 19 people dead, marking one of the deadliest attacks of the year amid talks of a ceasefire. Local sources said that more than 60 people, including children, were also injured in the strike on the city of Kryvyi Rih. Attack reportedly damaged dozens of apartment buildings as well as shops and businesses. The Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky strongly condemned the strike, calling it a violation of Russia's commitments during a ceasefire talks with the U.S. to protect civilian infrastructure. Meanwhile, Russia's defense ministry claims that the strike targeted a meeting between Ukrainian and Western military officials. Ministry said up to 85 enemy personnel, including foreign officers, were killed. Moscow and Kiev agreed a limited truce brokered by the U.S. last month. However, both sides have since accused each other of violating the deal by launching new attacks on energy infrastructure. And clashes have broken out between Italian police and demonstrators angry at a government security bill that will limit the right to protest. Hundreds of Italians gathered in Italian capital in protest called by labor unions and left-wing movements there. Now, protests are also held elsewhere across Italy as demonstrators condemn the right-wing coalition government of Giorgia Meloni for approving the bill. The bill, if passed by the Senate, will introduce severe penalties and imprisonment for acts of civil disobedience. It'll also grant special legal protection to police and military personnel. Human rights organizations and civil groups have denounced the bill as an attempt to silence dissent. A protest has been held outside the British Medical Association after Dr. Sui Chai Eng, a veteran NHS surgeon and prominent Palestinian rights advocate, was disinvited from addressing a British medical student exhibition. Her exclusion highlights a troubling trend within professional spaces where advocacy for Palestinian rights is increasingly suppressed despite widespread historical support for Palestine, as Saeed Puruza reports.
A show of solidarity with a woman they call a hero of truth. Dr. Sui Chai Ang, a veteran NHS surgeon and the founder of Medical Aid for Palestinians, disinvited to an event where she would have addressed British medical students. As well as a shock to the protesters here, the decision by the BMA was expected. Dr. Sui, a former war surgeon and author, has spent decades campaigning for Palestinian rights. Her frontline work during the Sabra and Shatila massacre in Lebanon in 1982 made her an international witness to Israeli atrocity and a lifelong advocate for justice.
I can't go in, right? I'm a member of BMA myself for 47 years.
In the middle, please.
And I've been respectable until I support the Palestinians. Supporting Palestinians.
Talking?
You pay a price.
Yeah, I'm finished.
Critics of the BMA's decision say it reflects a chilling trend in professional spaces where advocacy for Palestinian lives is being suppressed.
Every single union in this country, and I'm a member of two unions, has had passed resolutions historically in support of Palestine, in support of a Palestinian state. And yet the leaders of these unions have absolutely refused to mobilize their members.
18 months of the Israeli genocide in Gaza has already resulted in an unprecedented killing of at least 1,080 medical workers.
The protest outside the headquarters of the British Medical Association may be small, but it is part of an ever-growing movement for freedom of speech and the freedom to bear witness to genocide. Saipur is up in London.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
Diverse range of programs, spirituality, youth, Eastern tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is part of the speech delivered on April 26, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in meeting with a number of university students and academic personalities on the 24th day of month of Ramadan. When it is said that the elimination of ideology is necessary in the country, this means that the intellectual identity of society, whose important manifestation is universities and students, has to be destroyed. The elimination of identity means this. It means that the philosophical principles and the historical and national viewpoints of a nation should be humiliated. Their history and that of the revolution should be humiliated. The big feats that have been accomplished should be played down. Of course, there are some shortcomings, but these shortcomings are magnified 10 times. This is what the elimination of identity means. Then, Western philosophy must replace this identity. An example of this attitude is the American 2030 education agenda, which is an embodiment of the domination of Western neocolonialism in our age. This is one of the manifestations of it. Thanks to the revolution, the great legacy of thinking and culture was revived in the country. This has to vanish or be undermined. This is the goal of the enemy. Today, we have tens of millions of youth in the country who are ready to climb the peaks. That is, today, the youth of our country are really ready, some of whom have religious and revolutionary motives, and some may not have religious and revolutionary motives, but they are prepared anyway. They are prepared to launch a scientific movement and climb the summits of glory and national dignity. According to the enemy, these youth must become dysfunctional and disappointed. They must turn their backs on the peaks, and they must stop appreciating the path taken and blow a breath of cold and poisonous air in the trumpet of despair and render other youth hopeless as well. Today, this is being done. Therefore, we must stand up against this. One must stand up against it. When you come here and speak with an exemplary courage and power, we really enjoy this power of eloquence, this enunciation, and this solid rationale. They want to discourage these sentiments with temptations. They intend to inject a sense of dead-end situation in youth so that they feel that nothing can be done because there is an impasse and all efforts are futile. This is what is being done. This is the effort to destroy identity.
You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Cradle News Roundup, your one-stop shop for all news West Asia. My name is Esteban Carrillo. I am the news editor for the Cradle. And as usual, I'm joined by my colleagues, content creator and writer for the Cradle, Karim Shami, and content creator and social media manager for the Cradle, Sima Itayim. Just to get into Yemen a bit, because I don't want us to go too long into it, but Yemen has become the target of the U.S. War, of these very intense attacks that have been happening. We talked about it last week. Again, we know this is not going to resolve at the end of a gun, but there's also Iraq, right? Like, Iraq is also been starting to get pressure to dismantle the PMU and all of these factions from Israel. But as Karim often puts it, right, Iraq is just going to do whatever is told. And then at the end of the list is Iran, right, with the letter from Trump to Khamenei and the threats that are continuing. We heard a few months ago that Israel was planning to launch attacks on Iran with the U.S. help in 6 months, right? They said by the fall, right? So, again, none of us here have a crystal ball, sadly, but the way things are going, it does seem like this has kind of become the status quo, right? And I think one of the places that you can see it clearly clearest is in Lebanon, where, again, the Israeli occupation army has continued to launch attacks, killing several people just over this weekend in the south, in the east of Lebanon, threatening to expand attacks on Beirut again, obviously threatening the airport, obviously threatening the usual things that they do, civilians, and the United States standing right behind them saying, we are willing to give you a freedom of action, at the same time talking with the Lebanese leaders who are scrambling to put a stop to this in any way. But I feel like in Gaza, like in the West Bank, you as an Arab can do what you want to protect your people. But at the end of the day, if the biggest, the most powerful empire in history is standing behind this genocidal, suicidal nation that is on a warpath, I don't think there's much that you can do, right? And I feel very concerned about what may come next for Lebanon, because now we're hearing, over the weekend there was a rocket attack that was launched from Lebanese soil into the Metula settlement in Israel, and this was used to expand the air campaign. And then we were hearing some reports say that Israel may be trying to essentially do a false flag, right, to justify dropping bombs in Beirut and just expanding their aggression. Because at the end of the day, they want us to roll over. They want everyone to roll over to tap out and just to say, okay, we will normalize with you, but at what cost, right? And who is willing to do it? What do you guys think about what's happening in Lebanon, about this escalation? Because it's been coming from Syria as well, not just from Israel.
Karim, before I let you go, I mean, it's a one-sided war. Lebanon's under constant attack. We saw attacks yesterday in the south that killed, a citizen. And by the way, guys, just pointing it out there, if someone is in Hezbollah but is not in combat, then it is a civilian. So I just wanted to make that clear to anybody.
These are the rules of war, right? These are
the rules to anyone who was confused about that. So, your stuff doesn't fly with me. Anyway, so we had like very, very, very brutal strikes. They started before this thing happened, where on Saturday, 5 primitive rockets were launched at the Israeli settlement of Umtalle or Metula. And in response, Israel unleashed a heavy wave of airstrikes, like very heavy, on both southern and eastern Lebanon. And Hezbollah, which typically claims responsibility for its operations, denied involvement in this rocket fire. I mean, if you see the photo of the rocket launches, you'll know it's not Hezbollah. I mean, I think it's just agents working for Israel trying to give them excuse. But they don't need an excuse. Again, they don't need an excuse, so not so sure. Israel claimed to have targeted, of course, Hezbollah infrastructure, including command centers and rocket sites, and the death toll is at least 8 people. And of course, they're saying they're doing this to protect their civilians. And of course, the Lebanese state has remained completely silent. No condemnation.
Really?
Yeah, no statements. Oh, you're being sarcastic.
Breaking news.
No, just silence. Silence, for the South, it's like, of course, once again, all these decades later, nothing has changed. The South is treated as though it's not a part of Lebanon. It's totally neglected. And to make matters worse, since the truce was signed in November, Israel's reported it has violated the ceasefire not 1,000 times, not 1,500 times, but thousands of times. Mm-hmm. And of course, continues to occupy these new 5 strict positions. And Hezbollah has intentionally taken a step back. Hezbollah is not in a great place, is it? Heavily targeted, not given a moment to breathe. Even its newer leaders that have been recently appointed are being targeted one by one. Anyway, Hezbollah has given the Lebanese government and army space to act, standing behind the army and allowing the state a chance to rise to the occasion. But let's be honest, that's leading nowhere. So we are under a one-sided war. And again, it's like, oh, thank you to the government for working to make sure that Beirut won't be hit, because the south isn't a part of Lebanon. We should only worry if Beirut is hit, right? And anyway, this is Lebanon without the resistance, It's a Lebanon that plays into Israel's hands and that seeks complete inaction over justice at any price and, of course, bends to external pressure. Can't even muster up a statement to condemn strikes on its own land.
Currently in Lebanon and previously, and before even the assassination of Sayyid Hassan, Lebanon is either black or white. There is no gray part. You are either with Israel or against Israel. That's it. Previously, the majority or the power that Hezbollah possessed prevented the government to take some decisions such as normalizing, and that's it, and they didn't use their power internally at all. Currently, the power has shifted, but the people are still the same, and the people that believe in retaliation and resistance are the same percentage as before the assassination of Syed Hassan. But what happened now is that the power inside the government shifted, and now the people that are against Hezbollah are acting as if they were the people who fought Hezbollah, and they are taking decisions against Hezbollah as if they are the ones who won. Just to let you know how much the Israelis they are not even Zionists. Zionist is like a very beautiful word for them. They are Israelis. There's no difference. I think they will push for everything, and even the Israelis will tell them, "Khalas, stop." As what happened last month, if you know Arabic and you're following the Lebanese journalists that are aligned with Israel and Saudi Arabia, you will see that they were pushing for normalizations in the media with Israel, and they are preparing the masses. They are saying, if not this week, next week. And now when you go to the streets in Lebanon, you will see, I think the normalization is before the summer. The new school year, you will have normalization. And the funny part is that the Israelis went out and said, no, we don't want normalization now, because we have parts of your country. We don't want to make a new borders with Lebanon. We are happy as we are.
Yes.
And after that, the journalists and the people that go to the TVs, they stopped talking about the normalization, because Israel told them, no, that's not now, babies.
That's not what we want.
Talk about something else. So, in short, there's either black or white in Lebanon. You're either with or against Israel. If you're with Israel, currently you are pushing the narrative of the United States and the Israelis and the Saudi Arabians that everything is blamed on Hezbollah.
Indeed, Lebanon really is, between a rock and a hard place. It's a
By the way, there's a drone. There's a drone now. It came back. It's hovering above Beirut. It's really loud.
That's been the status quo.
For the Lebanese army?
No. It's an Israeli drone.
We saw the Lebanese Air Force a few days ago when they bombed Syria with their World War II planes. Sadly, that is, again, the status quo, that nations need to heal, nations need to be bowed, against the occupier, against the genociders, right?
Guys, this is Hossam. He was only 22 years old. You know him. This is the Al Jazeera correspondent, Hossam Shabbat. So, yeah, he was born in 2001. He's the second journalist they killed today, like within a span of less than 3 hours.
It's been 208 journalists killed. 208
maybe 209 now even.
We saw, it was one of the NGOs that attacks against journalists that said a few months ago that the biggest cause of death for journalists in war zones for the past year and a half has been the Israeli army. So again, this is kind of what has become normal, right? And just to finish my thought about what I want to say about Lebanon is that Lebanon needs billions to reconstruct for the damage that it has already incurred by the attacks, by the Israeli attacks, by the U.S.-backed war. This is money that is being offered, right, by the IMF, by the World Bank, by the Saudis, by the Qataris, etc., by the U.S., I guess. And everything's conditioned. Everything's conditioned, and more likely than not, conditioned on normalization. And as you guys said, more likely, as Ghassan Kanafani said, right, the neck does not negotiate against the sword. Sadly, that is exactly the position that Lebanon finds itself in. But we will continue to discuss this as the weeks go on. I want us to move to Turkey, a nation we don't often discuss on its own, but that has warranted discussion over recent days, because a huge protest broke out across Turkey, several cities, following the arrest of Istanbul Mayor Ekrem İmamoğlu. Over 1,100 people arrested as of this recording, including 9 journalists. İmamoğlu, a prominent figure in Turkish politics, and Recep Tayyip Erdogan's main rival, who could be considered, possibly the next president of Turkey in the upcoming elections in 2028, by the way. So Erdogan really acting way ahead of time to jail his competitors. Turkey at this point finds itself in a very interesting position following the fall of Syria, right? And they seem to have consolidated a lot of power, a lot of importance, in particular, you know, as NATO members. They are in a way the keepers of Syria, no? Of the ISIS government that is currently governing there. And also, an interesting report that I want to mention is that last week the EU, a report comes out last week saying that the EU is apparently reconsidering allowing Turkey into the union, right? To allow Turkey to become a full EU member. Why? Because they need a new arms dealer. They need to start buying weapons from someone else, because now we know that Europe is on a desperate rush to start arming themselves for their, you know, inevitable war with Russia, now that the United States has essentially left them, you know, standing out in the cold on their own. So all of a sudden, you know, being friendly with Turkey seems to be the correct move for them. So, you know, I just want to give that context to why, right, we are seeing essentially the breakdown of any, you know, democratic pretenses that may have existed in the former Ottoman Empire, to now become more of a, you know, only Erdogan can be in power, only Erdogan can protect our interests, only Erdogan can move forward. So what have you guys heard, what have you guys seen about what's been happening in Turkey?
First, to be honest, I'm not that professional in Turkey issues, internal issues, but of course we all saw what happened. We saw that the mayor of Istanbul. Was detained, and yesterday he was jailed, yani. They jailed him on
officially, yes.
Yeah, officially jailed. And we know that the mayor in Istanbul, he was elected by the people of Istanbul. And this is a big difference. Yeah, in our region or in Lebanon, for instance, usually mayors are appointed. But he was elected. That means that the people elected him and they love him for the city. That's why we saw many people went to the streets. But the background story, I read many things. And some people say that because he was... He had his education in Cyprus, and it was revoked. And with him, like 106 people were also their education was revoked. But the point is that, as you said, it's of course it's political. Yani, if he was from his party, this won't happen, and we all know this.
If he was from the AKP, right? That's Erdogan's party.
So, and the point is that I don't know his ideology. Yani, maybe both him and Erdogan is good for the country or bad for the Turkey, but we discuss here what's good and bad for the region. I don't know the stance of the mayor of Istanbul. Do you know about him? Do you know? Yani, he's good with Iran. He's good with the United States. He's good with Israel. Yeah, we have to know this before.
I would imagine he's not, you know, a very pro-resistant character.
I don't know, but what's happening here now currently in Turkey, as I see it, as a person who's not like too much into Turkey, this either will make Erdogan the ultimate leader for maybe at least one decade or two decades to come, or it will weaken him. We have to wait and see. And we know that Turkey now has like foots in many places in Libya. If Erdogan is weakened, because this is Erdogan's policy, I don't think this is the policy of Turkey. We have to differentiate this. And of course, Syria will be weakened if he's weakened. Or if he gets the full power, then he can do whatever he wants in Syria, in Qatar, in Libya. We have to wait and see.
Well, like, just to give a bit of a rundown in case there's anyone watching who has no idea. So he was, formally arrested yesterday on corruption charges, but also was previously detained for not only corruption, but terror links, you know, to the PKK. So the court accuses him of everything from embezzlement to rigging bids to unlawful data collection. And he called this like unimaginable slander. And he put out all these things on social media, like, I will never bow down and we will get through this and whatever. So initially, before yesterday, he was like formally arrested yesterday. So he was detained in a dawn raid earlier this week, just as his party, which is the CHP, began endorsing him as a 2028 presidential candidate. So, you know, the timing, you know, says a lot. And so, as you guys mentioned, his university diploma was revoked the day before his arrest. So this sparked what we can safely call the largest street protests in Turkey in over a decade across the country, and they were defying a four-day protest ban that the government enforced. They enforced a protest ban, and of course we saw riot police with tear gas and pepper spray and all that, and you mentioned the mass detentions. But so the point is, many analysts, including those who work with us here at the Cradle, see this as a political purge, you know, of mm-hmm. course, not a legal process. You know, it's an attempt by him to remove his strongest political rival, I guess, you know, ahead of the election. Because this guy is not, he's more than a mayor. He's like a national symbol of political hope for
because
many Turks.
When he's elected for Istanbul mayor, he defeats Erdogan's candidate, right? The CHP defeats the AKP candidate by like 20,000 votes. And some backroom maneuvering by the governing party in Turkey, which, by the way, Erdogan has been president for 23 years in Turkey. They rerun the election, right? They do it again. And then the second time, he wins by almost a million votes, right? So if anything, this sort of persecution works in his favor. And I would imagine down the line, it's probably going to continue to work in his favor after what happened last week. What I want to bring up to attention, right, is the parallels of what happened, what Erdogan has done over the past week with Imamoglu, with what happened with Imran Khan in Pakistan, right? When this very popular prime minister is removed from office in a legislative coup, sent to prison, given dozens of charges on everything, right? Just buried in legal cases. Him and his wife thrown in jail. His party is persecuted. His followers are persecuted. It becomes a war, right? In Turkey, it becomes a war against the PTI, if I'm not mistaken. That's Khan's party. In Turkey, it seems to be the same playbook in a way, and you know, because that's the empire playbook, right? This is what happens. This is what lawfare is. This is how you persecute leaders when you don't want to go into a country with marching, you know, with troops, or you don't have an ISIS, or you don't have, you know, you don't want to launch airstrikes and start killing people. You use lawfare. That's what happened in Brazil. That's what happened in Ecuador. That's what happened in Argentina. That's what happened in Pakistan. That's what happens, you know, everywhere. It's been happening everywhere for many, many years. And it's just, I think, again, this idea that Erdogan is their guy, right? He's the guy. He's the guy who brought down Assad. He's the guy who's friendly with Israel, who's friendly with Azerbaijan. He's the one that is wanting to kind of combat Iranian influence, right? He wants Turkish influence in West Asia, you know, to overtake whatever is left of Iranian influence. And here's actually what's interesting and what I want to hear your guys' thought about it, because Walla News, this Israeli news outlet, a few days ago comes out with this incredibly interesting report that says that Israeli officials are talking about a confrontation between Turkey and Israel in Syria being inevitable, and that there's preparations going, right, to essentially be a war between Israel and Turkey, which, by the way, you know, Israel and Turkey, they're allies. They've been allied for the longest time. Erdogan and Netanyahu, you know, two peas in a pod. Erdogan will give the loudest speeches about Netanyahu being a Nazi and a Hitler and whatever else. But then there's actual no attempts to break relations, to cut the gas that flows through Turkish pipelines to Israel, to end that trade. Remember when he poses the trade ban and then immediately a few days later starts giving waivers for companies to continue doing trade with Israel. And we have reports at the Cradle about how the trade has essentially not slowed down. If anything, it has increased since the start of the genocide in Gaza. So do you guys think there's any validity, right? Because let's just remember that Israel has been essentially one of the only countries in the world that has been referring to the Syrian government, the current de facto government in Syria, as an al-Qaeda government, as a terrorist government. And they say, too, that they are supported by Turkey, which is, yes, factual, it is. They're completely supported by Turkey. They are, you know, propped up by Erdogan. Is Israel going to go to war with Turkey in Syria?
Not war. I mean, there may be a Turkish threat.
On social media, they will fight on social media.
100%. Remember yesterday what I posted about the Channel 12 correspondent, that he was saying that this is like just a distraction, basically, like Netanyahu has directed the Israeli media to make it seem like Israel's gearing up for a war with Turkey. And this is to distract from, you know, all the internal crises and to be able to continue maybe, you know, everything else that he's doing. So do we have a feature? We'll put it up on the screen. by Mohammad Hassan Sweidan from a few days ago called The Battle Between Greater Israel and Neo-Ottomanism in Syria. So it gives a perspective on the kind of clashing interests between Israel and Turkey in Syria. But, I mean, even through this analysis, a war does not seem likely at all. Karim, go ahead.
Yeah, just maybe people will not understand how is that. You know, how they are talking like this, and there's like institutions who are saying that it's the war is coming between the two. If you read Egyptian or Jordanian newspapers, you will think that the King of Jordan tomorrow will go and like behead Netanyahu, and that al-Sisi will go and like drown the whole Israeli population.
I hope but you will place the picture of King Abdullah with the gun. He's cosplaying.
So that's it. The media and what these politicians talk is very different of what's happening on the ground. Not only Sisi. Before Sisi, we had Morsi, and we had before Morsi, we had Hosni Mubarak. Especially during Hosni Mubarak, there was, I think, four wars between, or not wars, we can say four aggressions from Israel on Gaza. And in the four wars, Hosni Mubarak refused to open the borders or to accept even people to like get medical care in Egypt. And Sisi, it's the same. Sisi is more smart, I think, because Sisi blamed Israel. He said, oh, look, we wanted to take them, but Israel didn't open the border. Although everybody knows that that Egypt has the authority over Gaza. It's like signed. There's a signed agreement that they have the authority. They can take people in and like open the border, but he didn't. So it's the same.
I just one idea about Israel and Turkey that like maybe this will put things into perspective is, you know, Israel, when there is an existential threat to Israel, Israel will set out to destroy its enemies. In the case of Turkey, there will be no war because there is no existential threat from Turkey. There's competition, and there is like, oh, they might be jeopardizing the current what Israel wants its regional dominance to look like, because Israel wants total dominance over the region.
To go back to the beginning of the discussion, right? At this point, Israel has reopened three fronts. They have opened the front again in Gaza, the front in Lebanon, and the front in Yemen, right? Even though the front in Yemen is not being fought directly by Israel yet, it's being just fought by the United States. Before we finish for this week, I just want to get your thoughts on like what is next for Yemen. What can Yemen do next that they haven't done already, right? Because they have already, since the expansion of this war, they have been targeting the U.S. warships, the USS Truman. They have declared Ben-Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv unsafe for travel. They say they were going to continue to launch attacks. They've launched, if I'm not mistaken, at least two Palestine 2 missiles, the hypersonic ballistic missiles towards Israel. Both of them, I believe, shot down. But they're on at this point, they're on their own, right? I heard also that one of their missiles, the fire actually fell in Saudi Arabia. So what is next? What is next for Yemen?
As I said last time, Esteban, I think, and people got angry in the comments because I said it, but I think unless they take footage from a drone or whatever, or a footage is leaked that they targeted a U.S. ship, okay, as if nothing is happening in the Red Sea. We only hear the news. And you too. You see that the Yemeni says that we targeted this ship, and then the Americans will have a counter post on Twitter say that they downed the drones or the ships or the cruise missiles. Unless there's visual evidence that this is happening, I think that's it, as if they are doing nothing in the Red Sea. But of course, they are... some of course, the Israeli shipping companies are in pain because they are really targeting them.
And to your point, Karim, about, we need footage, I think the biggest victories that Yemen achieved since the start of the genocide in Gaza were, first of all, the taking of the Galaxy Leader, right? This action movie footage of them landing on the ship. Incredible, incredible stuff. And the other one was the drone that Sima made reference to, which, again, also had the footage, the social media video of the drone flying in from the beach in Tel Aviv, completely on a post. So, I don't know, we'll have to wait and see, because like I think the title of the last week's videos was very, you know, appropriate. The unfinished wars, because this is really like all of this is just gonna continue. I know some of it is falling out of the news cycle. We haven't even discussed about the persecution that you know, anti-genocide protesters are facing in the U.S., in Europe, in other Western nations, the deportations, etc. We haven't talked about Mahmoud Khalil. So many things happening right now, and they're all the repercussion of what? Of allowing a rogue state to continue committing a genocide under the noses of the entire world.
Fruitful Moments with IRAD English Radio. Log on to our website at iranradio.ir. Log on to our website at iranradio.ir.
چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allah ya Allah subhanallah. Allah ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allah wa la ilaha
Dear audience, welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from Arab English Radio. This is Zainab Mousavi, and what we do in this program is to listen to certain viewpoints of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi, who was the great founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and then try to shed light and explain some precious points in their view. Well,
On the subject of faith and practice, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi said, a true believer does not only believe in the unseen, but also acts upon that belief with sincerity and devotion. This notion emphasizes that genuine belief is not merely an abstract acknowledgement of the unseen, such as the existence of God, angels, or the Day of Judgment, but is intrinsically linked to sincere and devoted actions in everyday life. In Shia thought, faith is deeply rooted in the Holy Book of Quran, which states, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. The believers are only those who, when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is mentioned, feel a tremor in their hearts. Surah Al-Anfal, verse number 2. You know, this verse conveys that a true believer's heart resonates with faith, moving beyond intellectual assent to a profound emotional and spiritual connection with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, and especially Imam Ali alayhi as-salam, emphasized that faith must be accompanied by action. He said, faith is like a bird. The heart of it is belief, while the wings are the action. Belief and action must coexist in true faith to thrive. These synthesis of faith and action is vital in fulfilling one's duty towards God, oneself, and the other broader communities as well. Sincerity or ikhlas plays a crucial role in Shia teachings. Actions performed with sincerity ensure that one's service to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and humanity is genuine and devoid of ulterior motives. Imam Khomeini's assertion also aligns with the Shia principle of niyyah or intention, suggesting that actions must be undertaken within the right intention towards God. In essence, this quotation reflects the Shia belief that a true believer demonstrates their faith not just through belief in the unseen, but also by living a life characterized by sincere, devoted actions that embody their beliefs. It calls for a holistic approach to faith, where personal integrity, social responsibility, and spiritual awareness are interwoven into the life of a believer.
Every night and every day, every night and every day.
Was a spring of truth, a selection of Imam Khomeini's viewpoints.
Never forget to say, La ilaha
Welcome to the Israel Watch. Hebrew media focused on the aggression against Gaza in light of Netanyahu's proposal for a captive exchange deal and the plan by Netanyahu's administration to displace Gaza's residents as well as internal Israeli divisions. We discuss these topics with Dr. Omar Nashabi, political analyst. Hello and welcome, Dr. Omar, to this episode. Hebrew media analyzed Netanyahu's proposal, and some commentators doubted that Hamas would accept it, despite its openness to the Egyptian initiative. Dr. Omar, where is Netanyahu taking things? In your own opinion, do you think he would derail any kind of negotiation despite Hamas's openness to the Egyptian proposal, to the latest Egyptian proposal?
I mean, every day more than the day before, it's very clear that the plan is to do a genocide in Gaza.
Yes.
And the objective of the genocide is to kill everybody. I mean, this is what a genocide is defined. It's defined as killing